Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I am your host, Brian Scott. Hope you got a chance to listen to my recent episodes from Ruth Montgomery. She's amazing, and I'm excited to return to her book, Aliens Among Us, and discuss a chapter she has on walk-ins from Sirius. If you check out my previous episodes on walk-ins, I have discussed what Ruth Montgomery found from her guides. Ruth Montgomery was a journalist, and she would communicate with her guides by just typing, and it would have all kinds of stuff come through, and she would then go out and investigate it like a journalist. So she's very unique in the way that she would do this. She learned from the guides about Sirius, and then started to find about certain walk-ins, and then goes and tries to find out about what these people are like and what kind of lives they live. For my own higher self, I have been told that it's incredibly rare for there to be walk-ins. A lot of people started saying that hey, I'm a walk-in, but it's incredibly rare. Most are starseeds that are born here. And so the phenomenon is unusual, but there are a number of them. And she went and tried to document what these walk-ins were. And if you are a walk-in, this may help you to understand the experience. Walk-ins from Sirius by Ruth Montgomery. Sirius, the heavenly body that the guides identified as the previous abode of Joyce Updike, apparently possesses qualities that develop some highly unusual personalities. Known as the Dog Star in the constellation Canis Major, it is the brightest star in the firmament and more than 20 times as luminous as our own sun. During the course of writing this book, the guides specifically named two other individuals who they said had sojourned on Sirius between Earth lives and who returned directly from there, this time as walk-ins. Certainly to me, at least, their remarkable talents seem unearthly. So let us consider these cases separately. Charlotte King of Sacramento, California, is a human seismograph. Far more accurately than any of the advanced scientific devices, she is able to detect impending earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, specify the time of the disaster, and pinpoint the locale. She can also, while blindfolded, correctly ascertain faults in the earth crust so that precautions may be taken. She's repeatedly demonstrated this ability to the bafflement of geologists and other scientists, having been thoroughly tested by physicists at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, as well as by scientists at the U.S. Government Bureau of Standards, the Neurology Health Center in Portland, the Western Thermographic Laboratory in California, the Institute of Applied Physiology and Medicine in Seattle, and Sacramento State University in California. Charlotte has predicted the exact dates and time of all the recent eruptions of Mount St. Helens, besides some 300 California earthquakes since 1979. Official government records kept on her predictions reveal 85% accuracy on earthquakes and 100% on volcanic activity worldwide. Dr. Frank Yatsu, the chairman of the neurology department at the University of Texas School of Medicine, has surmised that she hears noise generated by the earth itself. Adding, Charlotte may be detecting shifts in the Earth's electromagnetic field, which may also affect certain animals and cause them to behave in an unusual manner, a phenomenon long under serious study in Russia and China. A number of the scientists who have tested Charlotte conclude she hears in a very low frequency range, ordinarily unavailable to human ears. She explains there are a series of seven tones varying in pitch, frequency, and rhythm that she has learned to associate with seismic activity in specific geographical areas. She has learned through study and observation that when a particular tone increases in volume or overlaps another tone, a seismic event will occur within 12, 36, or 72 hours, depending on the intensity of the tone. Unfortunately, it is not tone changes alone that trigger her awareness of approaching seismic activity. A great deal of pain is associated with the phenomenon to the extent she is unable to hold regular employment because she is so frequently ill and is often hospitalized. These symptoms in head, chest, and stomach indicate to her the area where seismic activity is shortly to occur and the severity and type of quake or eruption. When Charlotte, who had read some of my books in the psychic field, called me in September 1984 to discuss her peculiar and inconvenient talent, she expressed the belief that it was some kind of karmic punishment for deeds she may have committed on the legendary continent of Atlantis many thousands of years ago. Intrigued by her story, I sought counsel with my guides, who declared Charlotte King came into that body as a walk-in from Sirius about 8 years ago, when she found that the occupant of a particularly sensitive body wanted to leave, and that this body would work well for her in mission to warn Earthlings of imminent disasters and give them time to evacuate dangerous areas if they wanted to survive in their present bodies. She's not quite the phenomenon that you believe, for there are others throughout the world with similar gifts of sensing earth changes and alterations beneath the earth's crust. Hers is not karmic indebtedness, but a divinely given ability to help others through her alerts. When I passed this message along to Charlotte, of whom I had never previously read or heard, she was impressed by the guide's far-ranging knowledge. It was true, she said, there are others with a like gift, and also true, she had been rescued from a suicide attempt 8 years ago. Recounting the circumstances, she said that on Christmas Day in 1976, jobless and separated from her husband, she was feeling such emotional and physical stress that she began gulping wine and found a half-full bottle of pain pills. I decided to take them all, she recalls. I just wanted out to end the emotional and physical pain caused by constant sounds that I was hearing, sounds like foghorns that no one else could hear. She said that she reached the hospital too late to have her stomach pumped out, but after 16 hours in intensive care, she suddenly roused and became aware that I did not want to die. I knew I had a job to do, that my kids still needed me and my marriage could be salvaged. It was apparently during that period that the old Charlotte, also a sensitive, departed, and the new replacement came from Sirius to alert Earthlings to the radical changes that were beginning to occur on planet Earth. The walk-in Charlotte did put the marriage back together for a while, but eventually was dissolved, and she asked me about a particular man who has been supportive of her endeavors in more recent years. I put her question to the guides, who reported Charlotte is doing exactly what she volunteered to come to do. She was on Atlantis shortly before the breakup of that continent into smaller islands, and knew from experience precisely what the sounds were like before the catastrophes there. In Atlantis, she was the wife of the man she mentions, and they were well matched there. He helped her to alert others to escape from dangerous areas that were shortly going beneath the sea. Asked about her childhood in this lifetime, Charlotte said it was an average one. I was raised on a small farm with two brothers and a sister. According to my mother and an aunt, until the age of 2 years, I used to scream every time I heard a low or vibratory sound, such as train or whistle or water going down the drain. I'm told there were times when I would drop my toys, turn my head and listen, but no one else could hear anything. I sighted my first UFO with my family in 1950 near Salem, Oregon. All I remember was my parents telling me that it kept pace with our car, and the airport also saw it, but did not know what it was. Now 38 years old, Charlotte says the foghorn noises that she began hearing in 1976 caused so much trouble in my marriage, because no one else could hear them, that after 3 months I filed for divorce. To determine whether the noises were psychic, she enrolled in a parapsychology class at the local college, and discovered that she knew things about the pyramids and their energies that were simply not in the books. Then came the suicide attempt that apparently resulted in the substitution of egos. Shortly thereafter, the new Charlotte determined to search in earnest for the causes and sources of the sound and the pain that no one around her was experiencing. A professor at Oregon State University came to her residence, and she was able by electronics to record the signals that she was receiving. She also had hearing tests in a specifically equipped booth and learned that although most people could hear at the 20 to 32 decibel range of sound, she heard sounds in the 7 to 10 decibel range. In early 1979, she began reporting changes in sound to a Portland, Oregon television station, and 72 hours later, a quake would occur. The stronger the sound, the larger the quake, she says, and the TV people concurred that I was correct 60 out of 60 times. Then on June 23rd, I awakened at 2 a.m. with a feeling of real fear. The sound was louder than I ever remembered and was definitely different. Later, I learned that about the same time began a 48-hour breaching of sperm whales on the Oregon coast at Florence. 41 large mammals died as a result of being crushed by their own body weight on shore. I believe the whales beached because they were not getting back the same echoes they were sending out. They became confused and beached. I passed this information on to the scientists who were studying their death, but they did not believe me. 2 days later, 4 quakes of moderate intensity occurred in Big Bear, California. 1 year later, a newspaper article said the scientists now believe the whales beached because their sonar was being jammed by the approaching quakes. So due to the loss of 41 beautiful sea creatures, I was able to put the sound and effect together. Soon afterward, Charlotte discovered that she would suffer severe physical pain, sharp sound effects a day or two before large quakes in such faraway places as Japan and Italy. And after they occurred, the symptoms would pass. By then, the scientific community was taking keen interest in this human seismograph. Scientific laboratories began in-depth testing of her strange ability, and after she accurately predicted the first eruption of Mount St. Helens in March 1980 and its massive later eruption May 18th, national television networks and magazines beat a path to her door. The Charlotte King effect, as scientists now call it, it is the prime subject of an ongoing study called Project Migraine that is being conducted by Christopher Dodge, a life science specialist with the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., whom she telephones each day that she experiences the familiar symptoms and pinpoints where the earthquakes or eruptions will occur. Dodge, who has a Master of Science degree from George Washington University, told me there's a very compelling evidence that certain people like Charlotte are actually tuning into the Earth's electromagnetic field and experiencing geomagnetic effects. As a specialist in electromagnetic field biology, he had for some time before meeting Charlotte been collecting fascinating anecdotal material about the advanced reaction of animals to impending earthquakes, and he sees no reason why humans should not be able to duplicate the feat. And it's a lot easier to work with humans than with animals, he added with a grin, because people can talk. He said that he became interested in launching Project Migraine after the U.S. Senate Committee on Science and Transportation asked him to undertake a research study into biological earthquake predictions. I first made contact with Charlotte King in February 1981, he recalls. She had approached the Library of Congress to seek assistance in identifying those factors that might be responsible for her hearing sensations. I was so impressed with her sincerity and her record of accuracy that I decided to monitor her supposedly premonitory sensations on a format basis to determine whether her claims were valid. Since a common denominator of these sensations is severe headaches, we both decided that the study would be called Project Migraine. Dodge set up the project as an independent undertaking apart from governmental activities and has since located a dozen other individuals who seem to share Charlotte's remarkable talents. He then established a telephone message system so that at the first warning signs, these sensitives can call in to record their symptoms and make their predictions on time tape for official verification. He says that the combined batting average for the group is 7 or 8 on a scale of 1 to 10. One of our subjects is a woman in New York City, the noisiest electromagnetic center imaginable, he declares, but she is particularly accurate about Italian earthquakes. She nails them every time. My role is to coordinate the predictions of these sensitives and run the verification, and we're beating the meteorologists at their own game. Some of my friends in that department say they come to work each morning and flip a coin to predict the weather, but we're right on the button. Asked about Charlotte's batting average, Dodge said that her performance has defied all expectations. She has been 100% accurate on Mount St. Helens and other volcanic activity, and over 80% right on earthquakes, when even 60% would have been remarkable. I look at the subject with cool, fishy eye of the biologist, he continued, and I'm convinced that just as some animals can give advance warning of seismic activity, so can certain humans. Some people try to classify this ability as psychic, a precognitive factor, and although I believe in leaving all doors open until we know more about the psi factor, I'm convinced that it's an actual ability to respond to geomagnetic effects. Particularly since the 13 people I've studied at close range seem to have similar reactions at the same time in advance of a quake of 5 or above on the Richter scale. Dodge said that after experiencing pain for some hours or days beforehand, a common denominator is that shortly before the actual quake, the pain leaves and there's a euphoric feeling. That's what I call the OO effect, he added. It means watch out because the quake is imminent. Dodge then gave me a fascinating account of personal experiences that he shared with Charlotte King. "Remember when there was to be a planetary alignment on March 10th, 1982, he began, and the prophets of gloom and doom were predicting a dire occurrence on that date. Well, the newspapers and TV stations asked me to make a prediction, but I refused because Charlotte was exhibiting no symptoms of anything out of the ordinary. I happened to be in California at the time, and the alignment day passed peaceably. It was, in fact, unusually quiet in the seismographic field. The next day, however, Charlotte became violently ill, and because her symptoms for volcanic activity are different and gave an earlier lead time for earthquakes, we made a prediction that Mount St. Helens would erupt on that afternoon of March 19th. We also notified seismologists at the U.S. Geological Survey and at the Volcano Center in Vancouver. As the time approached, although official instruments were showing no activity, television cameras were posted outside Charlotte's house, and reporters milled around at exactly 7:30 p.m., Mount St. Helens erupted with a bang, and Charlotte was vindicated again. How could she do it? How could she know that it would be 8 days off and not hours or weeks? I put the question to Dodge, who replied, "From experience, having memorized the signals such as the frequency of her headaches and the rumblings in her ears, she's able to pinpoint the location and the time, as well as the severity of the upcoming event. Charlotte herself says of the warning signs, the sensations change according to what the event is going to be. Steam bursts from a volcano are announced by building pressure in my temples and ears. An earthquake in the volcano is preceded by the pain in the center of my forehead. A series of four tones that cut off sharply means seismic activity in Northern California. Southern California is a series of tones that fade out slowly. A vibrational effect means the quake will occur in the ocean or underwater. Kidney problems, breaking capillaries, and heart spasms also seem to die directly into the seismograph. 2 years ago, while lecturing before a college psychology class, Charlotte began having severe stomach pains that felt like hard labor. When they failed to lessen, she was taken to a hospital for examination, but no physical cause could be ascertained. Shortly thereafter, a series of earthquakes occurred in the Sierra Mountains. Her pain ceased, and she now knows to associate labor pains with the Sierras and to predict the time and place of the ensuing quakes. In October 1984, she telephoned to say that she had now learned to identify a new symptom with another specific area. I called it seismic flu. She confided, "It occurs only when an earthquake will occur in granite, and since the only granite in this part of the country is in the Idaho and Lake Isabel areas, I've been predicting those quakes almost to the minute." Certainly the seismologist and television personnel, whom she regularly alerts when her various symptoms begin, are no longer scoffing. They all remember too well her telephone call of May 17, 1980, when she was violently ill and bleeding under the skin. "Mount St. Helens will erupt in 12 hours," she declared. "In exactly 12 hours and 12 minutes, the volcano blew its top, killing a large number of people who might have been forewarned to clear the area." Charlotte believes that hers is a teachable ability that others can learn, but given the disastrous effect on her health and the frequency of pain, how many of us would volunteer for such a thankless project? The guides have said that she volunteered to enter as a walk-in from Sirius in order to help alert Earthlings to the dangers facing this planet during these two decades. The United States government is baffled, intrigued, and sometimes embarrassed by her amazing accuracy. After all, Uncle Sam is expending millions of our tax dollars annually to support seismographic equipment and pay the salaries of scientists who monitor the stations, while Charlotte, who far exceeds their accuracy, lives virtually in want. Perhaps there is more fair play on Sirius than on Earth. In a last attempt to understand why anyone would willingly volunteer for such a life of service, I asked the guides to tell me what Sirius is like. Their response was this: "The star Sirius is a training station for those who are going on to other planets or returning to their own planets for special projects. It is a good place to test one's mettle and utilize the lessons that one has learned. Those returning from Sirius have strong motivation and willingness to sacrifice themselves for the good of humanity." The other person whom the guides identified as a walk-in from Sirius is David Paladin, an old friend to readers of Threshold of Tomorrow, a noted artist who now lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with his wife Linda. He was born on a Navajo reservation in Arizona, the son of a white missionary father and Navajo Indian mother. David had exhibited few abilities other than a talent for running away from home until the outbreak of World War II. when the wayward lad who had jumped ship in the South Pacific was hustled into uniform, given some training in cartography, and shipped to Europe with the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, forerunner of the CIA. In Germany, while mapping installations behind enemy lines, he was captured and thrown into a Nazi prison camp where he was grilled, beaten, starved, and left for dead by retreating Germans. Advancing British troops found 120 abandoned bodies and tossed them into a boxcar for removal from Germany for burial, but in searching them for identification, noticed a faint stir of life in one of them. As a spy for the United States, David had worn a German uniform without identification, and after being sent to British Field Hospital in Vienna, Australia, he remained in deep coma. Because he occasionally mumbled in Russian, he was then transferred to a hospital for Eastern European refugees, where he remained until fingerprints eventually identified him as a missing and presumed dead American soldier. Still in coma, he was sent to an Army transport hospital in Battle Creek, Michigan, where after 2.5 years, he at last regained consciousness. Asked his name, he promptly replied, "I'm an artist. My name is Vasily Kandinsky." That sounded sane enough, except for two conflicts. His fingerprints tallied with those of David Paladin and Kandinsky, the Russian artist who is the idol of abstractionist painters, had died in France at the age of 78 in 1944. When David would have been 18, to further complicate matters, as David became more alert, he admitted that he had never heard of Kandinsky and knew no Russian until he heard himself speaking it. The convalescing soldier asked the Red Cross for art supplies and promptly began to execute sweeping abstracts that caught the attention of the art world and were favorably compared with the paintings of Kandinsky in style and symbolism. The rest of David's fascinating story is detailed in my previous book, but the Indian boy, with only a sixth grader education, now teaches at universities, conducts workshops and seminars in the parapsychology field, and continues to produce remarkable paintings that some critics feel surpass those of Kandinsky. Several years ago, the guides identified David to me as the walk-in soul of the famous Russian artist. More recently, when he confided to me that he has had contact with space beings, I asked the guides for comment, and they wrote, "David is a highly developed soul who comes from Sirius, a planetary system, or those who have completed their Earth cycles go to learn how they may further serve humanity." They then related a curious story. Kandinsky, in later life, they asserted, had also been a walk-in from Sirius, and when the soul who is now called David Paladin was no longer able to keep that artist's body, he briefly returned to Sirius and then found the body of the soldier that he was able to revive for his work, which is concerned with the preparation of Earthlings for the New Age. He needed a body which would serve him in a setting where he could do the most good. That was the body of an American with Indian roots. Puzzled, because I had not previously heard of a case of two successive walk-in appearances, I asked, "Was David in Sirius during the long period of coma or before?" My guides calmly replied, "In both cases, he returned to revive the body from death, but spent most of the intervening time of coma on Sirius, until ready to resume an active Earth life in a well-functioning body." Not hard to comprehend if you realize that such highly developed souls are in and out of Earth lives quite easily, since they have mastered certain secrets as yet unknown to humankind. This whetted my interest to such an extent that I telephoned to ask David if he'd be willing to tell me about his experiences with the space people to whom he had fleetingly referred. David obliged with the following report. "For four consecutive nights in September 1961, my four-year-old son claimed that he was being visited by a person named Itan, who came into the house, awakened him, and took him into a big sky car, which he claimed landed behind our house in the Granite Dalles area of Prescott, Arizona. I paid little attention, believing it to be a childish fantasy. My attitude changed when my next-door neighbor, a forest ranger, told me on the third morning he had seen a flying saucer hovering over the area the night before. He also claimed to have seen my son, accompanied by a tall, thin man dressed in white overalls, walking towards a strange greenish light in the rocky area behind our house. He said that he had called out to them, but then seemed to forget the incident until he saw me emptying the garbage the next morning. We went into the house and talked to my son and asked what he remembered. He said he had gone for a ride in the sky car, going to where the earth looked like a little dot, He said that they brought him home and went into the garage where Eitan and a friend of his milked the truck that my neighbor had parked there. We trooped out to the garage and my son pointed to the oil drain plug, telling us that was where they had milked the truck. We checked the oil level to find it showing empty. On checking the oil plug, we discovered it to be loose, but there was no trace of oil in the ground. We considered reporting the incident to the sheriff, but decided that we would appear to be fools. We did discover that there had been numerous reports of flying saucer activity in the area for the past several days. Thereafter, on several occasions, my little son took my neighbor and me outside to point out different stars, naming them correctly. To us, that was amazing because the child had not been exposed to astronomy. 2 months later, I awakened one night to see a tall, rather thin, humanoid form standing at the foot of my bed. He appeared to be wearing a one-piece silver-white jumpsuit. I sat up to make certain I was awake. He identified himself as Eitan, my son's friend, and that conversation must have been telepathic, as I do not remember speaking aloud. Eitan informed me that he and his friend were from another planet that existed in another dimension. They had visited Earth for centuries and had attempted to make some contact with humans, but found most of them to be manipulative and selfish, causing his group to limit their visits. He claimed they had removed some genetic blocks from some humans in order to communicate and share concepts that could be of some use to humankind. He indicated they would never interfere with humankind's destiny, but would manifest as humans periodically in order to plant seeds for positive human growth. During the ensuing years, there was numerous opportunities provided to draw upon the many gifts so openly shared by our space friends with Linda and me, and our lives have been enriched as our desire to work toward a healing of the planet has intensified. Some years after that initial visit from Eitan, I appealed for help in a medical emergency and was telepathically instructed to drive from Prescott to Albuquerque to meet a medical doctor who, according to my mysterious source, would be able to assist me. I drove to Albuquerque, half expecting to find that my information was an illusion, but upon arrival I did find the doctor. He was working on cancer research and was with a government agency. Even though he was quite abrupt, almost to the point of rudeness, he was able to provide the much-needed assistance. My source told me that he was manifested as a human being for the purpose of providing humankind with a few new concepts in the field of medicine. I was informed that on occasion our space friends do take in a human identity, appearing with proper documentation and finding ways to plant seeds that may help us develop beyond our present limitations. The Dr. Manifest is now in Germany, active in research and also in the peace movement, openly sharing concepts for others to accept or reject. There are many others like him. I only hope that people will listen to those concepts and learn how to serve humankind better and to take care for the welfare of the planet. I asked David if he was aware of any further identity for his space friends, and he replied they identify themselves collectively as Kantarans. They are interdimensional beings rather than beings from our own space-time continuum. Their guidance of our race goes back to its early beginnings. They are devoted to help us without direct intervention, because they were at one time instrumental in helping us through a past cataclysmic period, and they had mixed with us genetically. I was informed that some humans are more responsive to them as a result of our own evolutionary growth. Some of us have fewer genetic blocks to our awareness, which allows us to communicate with them. This kind of communication helps us better to serve humankind. Are the Kantarians engaged in an eventual rescue mission? I put that question to David. He responded, while they would be willing to assure our biological survival in the case of natural cataclysmic period, they would leave us to find our own destiny should we outgrow our tendency to be exploitive, judgmental, and manipulative. They could consider a far more active partnership with us in our desires to reach the stars. My friends have insisted that we must accept the ultimate responsibility for our own fate as a species of beings. They would not prevent us from destroying ourselves. Only in the case of a natural cataclysm would they directly reach out to help. Then they would withdraw to allow us to utilize the concepts they have shared for our ultimate growth or destruction. Eager to know more about the Kantarians, I asked the guides whether they, like the Ashtar Command, have a circling fleet above us. This is their reply. The Kantarians come from Sirius, as did David Paladin, It is a remarkable start in that it gives free rein to development of all talents that are usable for the common good, and the Kontarians are indeed protectors of their people on the planet Earth, with whom they had early ties. Their fleet is smaller than the Ashtar group, but equally dedicated to helping Earthlings. Impossible to say how many will be taken off the Earth before the shift, as it depends in large measure on the willingness of those there to leave the Earth and go into orbit, and also to how many at that time will deserve rescue. The Kontarians will be helping with the alerts and assisting in rescue to some extent, although the Ashtar Command will be in charge of the actual rescue mission. As if in benediction, David Paladin sent me a personal message that he said his space friends had asked him to deliver. "Dear sister," it began, "concepts you share with others may well lead to a humanity that openly explores and celebrates its creativity, recognizing that the loving creative spirit is indeed the same as the Holy Spirit of your scriptures. It is our hope that humankind will listen to their inner voice and seek creative solutions to the problems that exist today, to build spiritual and moral foundation that will become their true heritage. Like a phoenix, it will rise from the ashes of any cataclysm that might threaten your planet. Even a cataclysm can be a great opportunity for change and growth. However, the seeds for that growth must be planted now." The message was signed, "Etan and Friends, the Kontarian Confederation." I had completed this chapter when it occurred to me that I had not told David that the guides say he is from Sirius. What if he objected to being so categorized? I hastily sent off a note, and by return mail, his warm response. As a matter of fact, he declared, for the past couple of years, he has been painting a number of Sirius works with such titles as The Dream Crystals of Sirius and Song of Sirius. And he added, "I have also been drawn to other Sirius people." Coincidence? Do you think? I doubt it. So here we get a really fascinating interview and discussion of two walk-ins from Sirius. And we get a lot of discussion in the Law of One material about being of service. And some of these higher entities will sacrifice everything to be of service. They will go into a body that will have constant migraines and pains so that they can help people avoid earthquakes. This is an amazing example of this service-driven mindset, which appears is trained into them when they go to Sirius in this particular storyline. So a lot of the walk-in stories are very similar. Somebody that is totally egoless, that jumps in to the fray with somebody who may not have been leading the best of lives, that wanted to start over somehow, and then boom, they come in and completely transform their lives and begin really being of service to people. The few walk-ins that I have communicated with online that I thought were authentic have been incredibly motivated by being of service in the most humblest of ways. So a higher being has the opportunity to be of service on this planet by doing something so painful. What can you do to be of service? There's so much potential and possibility out there. And the other thing I want to say is, after I did the walk-in episodes, I started getting weird messages like, "What can I do to bring a walk-in? I just want to move on and give it all up, but I'd rather have a walk-in." Don't think like that. Live your life. You are have the opportunity to be of service now. Everything can change. Your world can change. You're creating your reality now. Everything's okay. You don't need to have a walk-in. But these stories of walk-ins are fascinating, especially for those starseeds out there who are interested in this particular thing. Because a lot of people that listen to the podcast are starseeds, I believe, and they're drawn to these messages, and it's interesting to hear other people's stories in particular, and the walk-in phenomenon is super fascinating. We'll definitely come back to this with Six Planetary Travels and some other interesting chapters that Montgomery had. In any case, you can find all episodes of The Reality Revolution at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.